If you're a primary care clinician and you look after patients with IBD, this is the podcast series for you. My name is Charlie Andrews and I'm a GP. This podcast is brought to you by Crohn's and Colitis UK and the RCGP's IBD Spotlight Project. Crohn's and Colitis UK is the UK's leading charity for everyone affected by Crohn's and Colitis. The RCGP and Crohn's and Colitis UK's Spotlight Project aims to increase understanding, speed up diagnosis and support primary care clinicians to treat, manage and refer people with Crohn's and colitis. Throughout this series, I'll be bringing you expert advice from experts in various fields of IBD care, from diagnosis to nutrition advice and everything in between. Before we go any further, I just want to draw your attention to the IBD Toolkit, which has been developed with the support of the Royal College of General Practitioners and Crohn's and Colitis UK. It's a one-stop shop for clinical advice on managing patients with IBD and can be found online by searching for RCGP IBD Toolkit. There's top tips, guidance for the use of faecal calprotectin and plenty more besides, so make sure you take a look. Now, what better way to start this series than by talking to IBD clinical nurse specialist, that vital link between primary and secondary care management of patients with IBD. I'm fortunate and excited to have Aileen Fraser here with me today. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to talk to me. Aileen is an extremely experienced clinical nurse specialist who works at University Hospitals Bristol. She published various papers on the topic, teaches all over the UK, and has a wealth of knowledge on the subject. So, without further ado, Aileen, could you start by telling me a bit about what your role is and why did you choose to become an IBD clinical nurse specialist?
Okay, well, to start with actually your second question, I chose to become an IBD clinical nurse specialist because I worked and have worked in my years with some really excellent clinicians who actually made me incredibly enthusiastic about inflammatory bowel disease and actually taught me that what we see in hospital is only actually the tip of the iceberg. So the patients that I would look after on the ward and think that I'd sent them home and that everything was good and they were all well, that was clearly not actually the case. And that inflammatory bowel disease patients have a really difficult time at home. They can have a very difficult time accessing services and they can have a very difficult time managing their medication. So that's kind of why I became an IBD nurse. What do I do? I'm here for the patients. I would always say that I don't work for our clinicians. I work for our patients. I'm there for them when they have a problem. So especially on the advice line is probably the things that the patients find most helpful because inflammatory bowel disease is relapsing and remitting. And when you're in remission, all good, don't need to see me, don't need to come in and see us in the hospital. But actually when you have a relapse, your world can fall apart. You need to see somebody really quickly. And how you access that specialist care is by contacting the advice line. Or you started on a new medication, you're not really sure how you should feel about it or what should be happening, and you need to know what your expectations are. Again, you phone the advice line and find out. Because what we're really trying to do, we have very limited numbers of medications. We need to make sure that our patients actually use them to the fullest that they can. But also, if they're having a really hard time with azathioprine, for example, we want them to stop it at the right time also, because you don't want somebody coming in who's been vomiting for 6 weeks because they didn't have an appointment and they didn't know where to go. So I think that's what we do in terms of the advice line for patients. We also use the advice line for GPs. So lots of GPs contact the advice line when maybe there's not a very good plan written in the clinical letter. Sorry about that. Or, you know, actually, it's just gone beyond what would be in the clinical plan, or they're worried that they've got a new patient and they're struggling to get them in through what's should be an easy but sometimes a complex pathway to get patients into hospital, or they need advice on what to do today. And I think one of the issues that we have, and I know that you and I have talked about before, is how do you contact people? Because actually you ring us, leave a message on the advice line, I'm in clinic and I don't get it for ages, and actually you wanted to speak to me then, I try and phone you back, but I'm stuck trying to get through, you know, your telephone line. Lots of GPs will leave me their mobile number. I leave my mobile number for many GPs. Please don't give it out. But, you know, or you can do it by email, or you can page us. I think it's about finding the easiest and quickest way into services, and so that we don't all spend lots of time trying to contact each other, because actually that takes up our time. It stops us wanting to do it stops you wanting to do it. And when we're, what we're really trying to achieve is the best outcome for the patient and the quickest outcome for the patient. You know, I think it's really important that we have a really strong connection, and that we, I know I go out and do quite a bit of teaching to our GPs, and I think that really improves that connection with the hospital as well. So that's really important. What else do I do? I see patients in clinic. One of my favourite things. Really enjoy doing that. Have a really strong connection with people. And you, I've been in my job for quite a long time, since 2001. So I know a lot of my patients since 2001, because it's a chronic illness. So they have it lifelong, and I've gone through lots of things with them. That, you know, they're leaving school, they're getting married, they're, you know, driving tests, you know, births of their children, all that kind of stuff. So you get to know people really well, and that means it can make you know, the consultation very quick or very slow, depending on how much news they've got. But it also means that, you know, they tell you a lot about themselves, and sometimes I think we get to learn about the nuance of their life that perhaps in, you know, in your GP surgery where you've got maybe 5 or 10 minutes with somebody, I think it's probably practically impossible to do that. As CNSs, I think we're quite blessed really, because we do get to have that relationship with people ongoing, and because you have the phone calls in between or the emails, and we do a lot by email now. I'd have to say that has really shot up in recent years, and we probably get about 2,000 emails a year on top of the 80 phone calls a week on top of the however many clinics that we do. So we're kept quite busy also.
Sounds like it. It sounds like your typical day sounds fairly full. So you've got clinic work, you respond to the email advice lines.
Yep.
It sounds like you're very busy. So what would a typical day look like for you?
A typical day for me would look like going in, checking my emails, dealing with the ones that I can deal with. We turn the ones that we have a kind of a little bit of an unwritten rule, which if it takes more than two lines to answer, then it's a phone call, because actually otherwise it becomes too complicated. So do a bit of that. Sign off all our letters. Obviously we have to sign off our dictation so that you have a plan in the post, so that you know what's going on, you know what we've been doing. Also, we have the biologics. So the biologics, which I'm sure you've heard about, you guys don't necessarily have to deal with particularly much, but it's a massive part of our job now. I know in the BRI, we've got more than 600 patients who are on biologic therapies. That means that they will have to have monitoring. And that monitoring is very often done in the surgery. So thank you for that. But actually somebody has to, you know, be in control of those results and then doing all of those prescriptions. And for the BRI, that's me. So that's quite a lot of prescriptions, as you can.
Sounds like a fair amount of work there.
Yeah, can imagine. And actually, and it's the bit before that. So it's all the screening. So we take screening very, very seriously. We need to make sure that they, you know, that we're not putting them at risk. TB is a problem. Even around here, we've had a number of cases.
Okay. Yeah.
And things that we never thought of before. So people who've been traveling. Mm. So a lot of our young people travel all over the planet, frankly. And, you know, we've had somebody who had already been on a biologic, came back from having had a long trip abroad and came back with TB.
Right.
So, you know, just if the one thing, you know, do be aware of that. So if they're coming in, they're coughing and they're sweating, you know, do actually think about it, because it can be missed. That we're much better at it, I think, now than we used to be. So that all that screening takes a long time. Managing the patients through that, explaining to them what's going to be going on, again, managing their expectations. It involves a lot of admin. We now have a full-time administrator, actually, because of that, which has been really helpful, because actually I think what can happen is that your time is taken away from doing your clinical nurse job by doing admin, and we're very keen to actually do what we do best, which is work with the patients rather than just filling a bit of paper. But it can take up an awful lot of time. And then there's doing clinics. So my clinics are always quite busy. I know you've been to one before, so you know it's good fun, but it's a long old morning. In two of our lunch times are taken up by MDTs. One lunchtime is taken up by an education session. And in the afternoon I mostly spend doing either my admin or speaking to patients on the telephone or contacting patients to start them on the new medications, or doing some teaching or service development, which is a big thing also, because these services are, my job is wholly changed from what it was when I came into it 18 years ago. So that's really important. Things are changing all the time. You know, how we get education out to people in terms of podcasts,
yeah.
You know, everything's changing all the time, and we have to keep up.
You talked about clinics and that continuity of care. It's vital, isn't it? It really helps.
Absolutely.
When you know what's going on in someone's life. And actually, as GPs, we really value that as well. So it sounds like that's a big part of what you do.
Yeah.
And understanding their circumstances really helps you,
yeah,
which is really good.
I think also it's when, so I mean, as you say, when I get a call from a GP who, and I get several calls a week from GPs, and you know, you can say to them what, you know, when that person knows who they're talking about and what they're talking about. And they had a call recently and, you know, we talked about the fact that this patient was outside of the box, you know, and I really appreciated the GP took time to call me. We exchanged, you know, our mobile numbers. I managed then, because he managed to text the patient for me, because the patient was, you know, didn't know who was phoning. Text the patient for me, knew it was me phoning, and managed to have a conversation with the patient, managed to get them to agree to start treatment. Couldn't get them to go where I would like them to go or where I could send a prescription to, but negotiated with the GP that they would do the prescription that I would normally do. And actually, that's when I think that the NHS is doing its absolutely best work. We're working collaboratively to, you know, to get the best result for the patient, which is surely what we're all after.
That sounds like an amazing example of how you can act as that linchpin trying,
yeah,
to hold it together, and the effect that we can have, it's so rewarding, isn't it, if we,
yeah,
can make that work.
Yeah.
It's so nice. And you also talked a bit about that, the advice line, and I was hoping that you might be able to draw out some things that GPs tend to ask, some of the commoner things that that GPs are often asking about.
I think, so GPs often phone up and ask about what medication people can be on. So, you know, what kind of doses patients should be on in terms of the mesalazines, the medications that actually, what are we trying to do? We're trying to get the patients, especially on mesalazines, to be fairly in control of that themselves. So what we should be teaching them is, what's your minimum dose? What's your maximum dose? You know, if you're going to be using, if you're going to be topping and tailing, as we call it, so using oral and rectal preparations, then, you know, what rectal preparations should we use and when? And sometimes we're not very clear about what works best where. So I'm just going to tell you. So if you've got somebody who's got rectal disease, you want a suppository. If they've got disease that goes into their sigmoid, you want a foam enema. If it goes all the way up the left side, you want a liquid. Okay, and if you use a foam enema, sometimes, dependent on the length of the nozzle, you'll completely miss the rectum. So you need to use a foam enema and a suppository. So when we prescribe those, we are not being bonkers. It's just that actually we know how they work, you know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when we prescribe things which are, maybe they're not the cheapest medication on the block, but it might be that we have a really good reason, and that reason is because, you know, it's much easier for the patient to use. There are some of the medications that actually are quite difficult to actually manipulate at all, and it might be that the patient has got arthritis in their hands and they would never be able to use it. So, you know, and that's always, you know, that's always worth a conversation. And sometimes, you know, our decision making may not be very clear. Or a lot of people will phone up about, a lot of GPs will phone up about monitoring. So about maybe azathioprine monitoring, methotrexate monitoring. We do have shared care protocols. Hopefully we'll have sent those out. So that would be the first port of call to look at those to see whether, you know, would we be worried about an ALT of 65? Probably not. You know, but actually it can be dependent on the patient, and if you're worried then you action it. But I mean, I'm always happy to, you know, to have those phone calls about, you know, about monitoring, because it's really, really important. And what we don't want to happen is we don't want medication stopped needlessly, because sometimes it's difficult to get people to start back on it again. You are their GP, you know, they really trust you. They, you know, anything you say is gold. So if you say, for example, with a pregnant patient, you know, stop your azathioprine because you're pregnant, we would never do that, you know, and actually it's really difficult. And I know from my experience that it's practically impossible to get a patient to restart on it, regardless of what I say, because they are so worried about the baby and a doctor has told them that they have to stop it. So always happy for a phone call about that. And I think the thing I would say for GPs is, obviously, when you've got a patient who's on a biologic, I know that very often it doesn't make up your list of drugs because you're not administering it. I always say to my patients, you know, if you have an infection, you go in and you tell the GP that you're on a biologic, because it won't necessarily be there.
Mm-hmm.
And actually you'll look at a patient and say, you're 35 years old, you've got a chest infection, you know, or, you know, you've got a viral infection, you'll get over it. For our patients, actually, we need them to be treated much more rigorously and in a way you possibly wouldn't think of, just because they're actually on a biologic and their chances of getting unwell really quickly are really high.
Yeah.
The other thing is, if they've got an illness, if they've got a viral or bacterial illness, they can't have their treatment. So we need to get those illnesses treated as soon as possible so that they can get back on therapy, because otherwise we lose ground. And the same thing applies to when they have surgery. So when they have surgery, we need to stop treatment. So we need to sometimes try and factor all of that in when we're making those decisions about surgery and other treatments.
Yeah, it's an important point. And for GPs, I think it's important for us to be aware that, you know, we do need to have those medications on our screen so that actually when they come in, it flags up. So they should be on a medication list and it should be there so that we're aware.
Yeah.
You know, communication is key, isn't it, really?
Absolutely.
I think a lot of what we've talked about so far is communication between primary care, secondary care. And do you have some advice on how, for me as a GP, for other GPs, how we could help to improve that two-way communication? You know, I know there's a drive to make sure that action plans are on are on clinic letters so that we have an idea of what to start when flares do occur. Do you have any other advice?
I think, you know, find out the email address of your IBD nurses, because that's actually going to be key for you, because actually we check our emails all the time and we will always get back to you.
And where could you get that? Where can you get that information?
So it should in fact be on the letterhead, obviously, right. But if it's not, then if you go to CC UK, you can find out who your local nurses are. And it won't necessarily tell you what their name is.
Right.
Okay, it doesn't tell you what their name is, because it's not about us as people, but it'll give you the email address for the IBD nurses in your area. They've got, if you go onto the webpage, they've got a map. They've got an interactive map. You can just put in your postcode, and it'll tell you who's around, which is brilliant. Obviously, you can probably go onto the hospital websites, but all hospital websites are a bit variable, to be honest.
Yeah.
But I think that's probably the best way. But it should be
helpful.
Yeah, but it should be on the letterhead. I think finding out who those people are, using advice and guidance if you have that in your area. I mean, sometimes it's not fast enough. If you've got somebody who's in front of you and they've got, you know, they're having their bowels open 10 times a day and they've got blood, they've got mucus and they're losing weight, you know, even if they don't have a tender abdomen, you really want to speak to somebody now. And I know that within the BRI, we have a pager system, so you can page us as long as it's between 8 and 4. But you can page us and we will always, you know, we will always speak to you, and we will always try to negotiate actually an admission that means that it comes through us and goes, you're going to the right ward at the right time rather than coming through the emergency department, which is a lot easier for everybody, you know, patients and us included, I think.
And I guess on that line also, you could use the gastroenterology registrar on call.
Absolutely.
But in areas where they do have a nurse specialist, that's certainly an option, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it certainly is. And actually, we are probably best placed because most of us will have been around for a while. So most of us know everybody in the hospital and know how to get somebody where you want them to be.
And what about, you know, if we do start someone on treatment in the community, is that something that the nurse specialist would like to hear from us, for example?
Yes, they would, especially if you're starting them on steroids.
Right.
Okay. What we really don't want to happen is that we think we've got a patient out in the community, they're doing fine. We think that because I haven't heard from such and such for a long time, and we actually think that everything's fine and hunky-dory, but it turns out that they've been going and having repeated short courses of steroids, and actually, you know, out of a 12-month period, if you look back, they've probably spent 6 months on steroids. That's not a great result for us, because what we, you know, our default position is, if you're on a second course of steroids in a year, we need to start a different treatment. Your maintenance treatment is not working. But we don't know that unless you tell us. So very often what will happen is that I get phone calls from patients saying, I've been to see my GP, they've started me on some steroids, they told me I needed to give you a ring. Okay, so those are the good patients who do what you've asked and do give us a ring. But there are some patients who actually, you know, they quite like the steroids, they work really well, make them feel really good, it gives them a general sense of well-being, they don't see the harm in it, and they're not thinking about the fact that their bones are becoming really brittle. That's not an issue for them because they can't see that right now. So, you know, I think if you've got somebody that you've started on especially a second course of steroids, please do let us know. You know, and whether that's by even, you know, just by email or whatever, that would be great, because actually it means that we know to flag that person up. Because the other thing is, they're the ones who don't attend, you know, or maybe just, you know, they've had a late appointment and that's why they've come to you. But it means that we can actually, you know, focus on the people that we need to focus on.
That's a good message, isn't it? I think just, you know, if we are starting steroids, perhaps just sending an email, it's doesn't take long, does it? But just getting an email across so that we're all aware of what's going on. Because then when you do see them in clinic, you can see how many flares they've had.
Yeah.
Final advice for GPs. Do you have some key messages, key take-home messages that you can...
Things that I'd like GPs to know. Do a good history, okay? And when you do that history, please keep in mind what disease the patient has and where that disease is, okay? Because that makes a big difference. I think that there's a big kind of thought that, you know, is you have to be having your bowels open six times a day and you have to have a fever, and that might not be the case. If you've actually got, you know, quite upper gut small bowel disease, the biggest issue you might have is that you feel sick. If you've got terminal ileal disease, the biggest issue might be that you're getting lots of pain. I've had one lady that she got no other symptom other than pain, but she got dreadful pain. It was quite excruciating, and she ended up that she had a pinhole, and that was the reason why. So you need to be really, really careful when you're doing your history, that you actually think about what the patient has, where what disease they've got and where they've got it, and actually think about in your head what that might mean. You might have a patient that will come into you and say, oh, well, you know, Dr. Andrews, I'm having my bowels open seven times a day. Yeah, you've got an ileorectal anastomosis. That is no way a surprise, is it? Because you don't have a colon. So that's, you know, so it's about finding out what they've got, where they've got it, and putting that together with their symptoms, you know, and also asking the patient, what's normal for you? Okay, because that, you know, it might be that going seven or eight times a day is completely normal. So you have to put all of that together, I think. And also, I guess, remembering, you know, the kind of first principles, just because somebody's got an inflammatory bowel disease, not everything is due to their inflammatory bowel disease. So to remember to look for other things. We do find cancers in these patients. So if you've got somebody who comes in with a raging anemia and you're not sure why that is, do the normal tests to do top and tail them, you know, or send them back to us so that we can.
I've learned a lot from listening to you today. Lots of really useful points. And, you know, a lot of that is about sharing and communicating, knowing your patient and working as a team. So, you know, I've learned a lot from that, and I'm sure our listeners will as well. So thank you very much for taking time to speak to us today. That's all we got time for today. But for further information, don't forget to have a look at the RCGP and Crohn's and Colitis UK IBD Toolkit online. Thank you very much.
Thank you.